This is the University of Alaska Radio Forum. Each week at this time, Forum presents a topic of timely and pertinent interest to Alaskans. Now, here is today's host. This is Tom Duncan, and welcome once again to the University of Alaska Radio Forum. On March 24, 1972, the University of Alaska Fairbanks was privileged to have as a guest speaker and lecturer the poet John Chiarty. Mr. Chiarty spoke to an assembled group in the Great Hall of the Fine Arts Complex and was introduced by Professor Gordon Wright of the University of Alaska Department of Music.
There's a fine line of distinction between music and poetry, and the two arts have held hands many times, often embracing in the great songs of Schubert and Hugo Wolf. Poetry has inspired musicians to their highest creations, and I suspect that music has often been the guidance for poets. I believe that T.S. Eliot acknowledged this, as did Dylan Thomas. Of course, there's always Tennyson, who complained, "Why do those damn musicians make me say a thing twice when I said it only once?" My first encounter with our guest this evening was at the University of Wisconsin about a decade ago, and I must add that it's glad to see the University of Alaska is finally catching up 10 years later, when he read his poems and spoke about his art. It was a fine experience for me to see the lines of printed page brought to life by the poet. The lines and stanzas of his poetry, which I'd often read to myself, were suddenly realized by their creator with the inflections, the rhythms, and pulsations. My feeling is that no one in the United States has done more to bring the art of poetry to his countrymen than John Chiarty. As a poet, teacher, scholar, and author, and through his many years of the Saturday Review of Literature, he has brought pleasure and insight in many lives. It's our pleasure to have him here to share his ideas with us. Mr. Chiarty.
Thank you, Professor Wright, ladies and gentlemen. I think there's an officially announced topic for tonight, and I don't like it. I made the mistake of getting myself into the clutches of a lecture agent because I didn't want to be bothered with details, and I hate writing letters. Then he went ahead and invented some titles for me. Now, whatever the title is, please forget it. It wasn't mine, but his copywriters. What I want to talk about is some of the ways in which poetry seems to happen. Seems to me that when it happens right, something human and important follows. But it can't be gone at directly. Indirection is perhaps the name of the game. A good poet, now dead, a friend of mine who was an excellent violinist, once did a poem called Fiddle Practice. And he spoke of how putting his fingers on the instrument in the right way made all sorts of things happen. And he concluded, "The sounding board is all the fiddle needs to speak alive. The learned heart less in love with singing than with how to sing. A scale can sculpture Bach or make the mountain move, but love without arithmetic will fail. The vision must be caught by indirection, the bow arm aimed at technical perfection." I think perhaps Professor Wright would agree with me on that. And I like to stress the point because so many of the young poets are out to spill what one of my friends called brute soul. They say, just let it out. No containment, no measure. I feel, oh God, how I feel, seems to be the message of the poem. And perhaps he does. Kerouac, I think, is the father of this, one of the fathers of this heresy. He once remarked that he used to put a roll of paper in the typewriter, and he would then type 8 to 10 feet a day. And he added, you can check my quotation, it's not exactly accurate, but Cleveland Amory did a book called The Celebrity Register with little interviews in this. And what Kerouac said in The Celebrity Register was, "And I never change anything, because exactly what you would be tempted to change, that is what would be most interesting to your doctor." Well, you see, that assumes that every reader wants to be Kerouac's psychiatrist. And I gave up on his psyche very early. I reject the role. The only way, it seems to me, to read earnestly, humanly, or intelligently is selfishly. If the poem gives you an experience of selfish participation, that's it. Young writers are always assuming that the reader owes them some debt of sympathy for trying. The fact is that the poem doesn't really care what it costs to put on the page. I think within our human perversity, we're all rather secretly glad that Keats did die young. It saves us the trouble. He's a sort of sacrificial goat somewhere within our psyches. And the fact that he died young allows us to feel sad for him without having to die young. We rather like it when the poem is expensive, when it costs a lot to put it on the page. It confirms us in our wishes for some sort of sacrifice, I think. But nevertheless, what you get off the page is an experience. Now, these are high thoughts. I'd better get back to my own level and start low. I have an experience with a poem, and it's a possibly useful example because it's a frivolous poem. And therefore, your high-mindedness, your intellectuality, your last five messages from the universe don't have to get into the way of participating with the process. And I think some useful notions can be extracted from this poem without invoking this other thing. Because what happens most often is that when people set out to write important poems, they tend to get pompous and blind. It's a mistake of the bad writer to try to say too much. Someone once wrote me at the Saturday Review, I've forgotten her name, and I had forgotten her poems, but she was angry about my having rejected them. And the letter came on one of these blue letterheads with a large white monogram on it. And what it said, in effect, was, I suppose you rejected my poems because they were about God. Well, that's one way of defending yourself. That irreligious so-and-so doesn't realize how close God and I are, and therefore he rejected my poems. Well, I don't usually answer that sort of letter, but every once in a while I feel nasty, so I did send her a letter. I said, Dear Madam, no, I did not reject your poems because they were about God. I rejected them because I could not conquer a feeling that you were unequal to your subject matter. I hope she got the point. But this is one of the things that happens when you reach for huge subjects. We had an instance with a sonnet beginning, My soul is a lighthouse keeper by the sea. And I was supposed to criticize this poem, and I said to her, how do you keep me from reading that my soul is a lighthouse keeper by the sea? That's one of the things that happens when you get big. The critical perception shuts off, and therefore I want to start small. This poem is called Widgeonry, and for reasons I won't go into here, I was looking up the word widgeon. I wanted to find out its derivation, and the stupid dictionary I looked in just said origin uncertain, but I have an Oxford English dictionary, and I moved across the room and finally ran it down to vipio, which is Latin for heron, and I satisfied myself on that. But while I was looking at this unworthy thing called a collegiate dictionary, I looked up the page, and that was the word Wikipedia. And Wikipedia was a new word to me. It turned out to be the Algonquinian Indian word for, quote, this one I memorized and seared into my memory, any of various native deciduous hardwood trees, including Tilia glabra. That's a stupid definition, you see. A lexicographer who defines that way should do 6 months penance on the rock pile. Well, Tilia glabra, as I get stubborn on these things, I ran it down, is the bastwood or the basswood or the leatherwood tree. And finally, after 6 years of looking, I found one last summer in northern Massachusetts. It's a lovely tree with a big heart-shaped leaf, and it tends to grow in clusters. All right, that's all to one side of nothing, really. But as I was looking up the page, I had a thing. Widgeon and Wikipedia were in my mind, and I had a thing started. A widgeon and a Wikipedia. A widgeon and a Wikipedia. It wants to dance. It promises to get airborne if I can just get some gas into it and take it down the runway. Maybe I'll throw it away. But here's a first aesthetic principle. And never, never forget it. If I published that poem in the Saturday Review beginning, A Widgeon and a Wickapee, I would get 500 angry letters saying, you idiot, whoever saw a duck roosting in a tree? So the second line was to cover myself. A Widgeon and a Wickapee, in which no Widgeon ought to be. See, now go ahead and write your stupid letter, I'm covered. And the aesthetic principle is, never give the reader a feeling, the right to feel smarter than you are. Readers are just as insecure as writers, and given a chance to feel one up, they'll take it. And you will lose in this, you see. That's maybe not a very high critical principle, but it's a fundamental one. If the reader thinks you're a fool, you've lost him. You have to cover yourself. Well, all right, I was going, a widgeon and a Wickapee, in which no widgeon ought to be, a widowed widgeon was. All right, now, I didn't really know what I was starting, but I'd like to point out to you, as seriously as I can, that by the time I have written those 2.5 lines and invented this very crude little stanza form, 2 long lines and 1 short one, rhyming AAB, I have signed a number of contracts that must be legally fulfilled. I did not know I was going to pick up these contracts, but they're mine now. For example, I have a contract to alliterate. You can't alliterate that heavily for 2.5 lines and then just stop alliterating. Now, I didn't have to start alliterating. At what point did I pick up the contract? A widgeon and a Wickapee? Two W's isn't enough. In which no widgeon ought to be, I could get away from. But when I add a widowed widgeon was, then I have to do more alliterating. I can't just stop. Now, I could, I suppose, go on to a different sound on which to alliterate. I don't have to stay with W's. But I have a feeling this is going to be a short poem anyhow. If the poem begins, Ama Wirumque Kano, you know that's for the long run. It's going to take you more than one night to finish it. But if it starts a widgeon and a Wickapee, the chances are it's going to be over in 12 or 16 lines or something of the sort, 15 lines. And therefore, the harder contract is more interesting than the looser one. The same thing with the rhyme scheme. I have AAB, and a normal way to rhyme it would be CCB, picking up that short rhyme. And then say I do 2 more stanzas, I could go DDEFFE, but it would be tighter and neater if I make it AAB, CCB, DDB, EEB, rhyming all of the short lines. And since it's a short form anyhow, why not? The tighter contract is better one than the looser one. And I point out to you one thing, I cannot honorably finish this poem until I explain how the widgeon got widowed. I didn't have to widow it. As a matter of fact, I didn't even mean to. I was looking for W's. And widowed is nice because it has a sounded and a silent W in it. I could have said a wistful widgeon was. And then my contract would have been to explain the wistfulness of this widgeon among all other non-wistful widgeons. Or I could have said a winsome widgeon was. That would set another contract. But the point is quite simply this. I had none of these notions in mind when I began writing. A line and a half ago, I had none of these notions in mind. I'm trying to point out, in a frivolous example perhaps, certainly a frivolous example, but a not frivolous perception, that a poem is in a way a series of contracts run into by serendipity that then must be very firmly and legally observed. Otherwise, one is cheating. And there's no, it's ridiculous to cheat a poem. The only reason for writing it is to write it as honorably and as honestly as possible. So, all right, I am committed to W's. And another thing occurred, I think this is an aesthetic principle too, the word wiki-up came to my mind. Now, wiki-up is a little frame of boughs, supple boughs. The technical word for them, though not very common, is withes, W-I-T-H-E-S. And you bend them into shape and you have a little frame over which to throw a buffalo hide if you happen to have a buffalo hide with you. And it's and Indians did, so they made little wiki-ups in which to sleep for the night at times. But wiki-up, you see, is an Indian word. Wiki-up is an Indian word. They sound very close together, and therefore you want to match the tonalities. I want W's, so my second one is Wiki Up, and since I want some Indians in this Wiki Up, I had to go looking for W Indians. And there are not many W Indians, and none that would serve my purpose in any of the lists I looked down. This may be a frivolous poem, but I looked through the names of a lot of tribes of Indians and came up with nothing until suddenly it occurred to me that Wichita had to be named for something. And if it did, if Wichita didn't turn out to mean buffalo or the place where two blades of grass lock together or the name of something else, if it did turn out to be an Indian tribe, that would be glorious, because the plural of Wichita is Wichitas, which rhymes with was, and very few things in English do rhyme with was, you see. And that was my luck. It turned out there was a Wichita tribe, and otherwise I think this poem would never have achieved its splendor. He would have died a borny. So I had a second stanza. While in a willow wiki-up, a Wichita sat down to sup with other Wichitas. And now all I have to do is one more repetition of the pattern, explain the widowing of the widgeon, and I'm out of it. And the whole poem came, a widgeon in a Wikipedia, in which no widgeon ought to be, a widowed widgeon was. While in a willow wiki-up, a Wichita sat down to sup with other Wichitas, and what they whittled as they ate included what had been of late a widgeon's wing. 'Twas thus the widgeon in a Wikipedia in which no widgeon ought to be, a widowed widgeon was. That isn't really a high watermark in English poetry, and I invite you to have what fun you can with it, but I am very serious about the principles I am trying to assert of the poem as an experience of discovering its own contracts. As you write it, you are introduced to your obligations, and the obligations then have to be fully and firmly met. At times, people try to cheat. One of the best examples of a man tempted to cheat but who refused occurs in the worksheets of Keats' The Eve of St. Agnes. You recall it's a medieval tale, sort of Montagues and Capulets. Porphyro loves Madeline, but their families are a-feudin'. Subplot, if on the eve of St. Agnes a girl performs a certain ritual which includes not looking behind her, she will dream of her own true love forever. Second subplot, the aged beldame, Angela, smuggles Porphyro into Madeline's bedroom and hides him there. Now, Porphyro arrives with a basket full of inedible dainties. When I was living in Boston, some of you may know of S.S. Pierce, as they call him there, and I tried to get S.S. Pierce, I prefer to call it Pierce, to make up a little basket of poisons called Porphyro's Basket. It included cinnamon sticks and jellies and other inedible concoctions, selected because their sounds were so delicious. You see, this was not dietetics, it was phonetics that was the working principle. And Porphyro hides in the closet, and Madeline enters and begins to undress. So first she prays, and Keats has this marvelous passage. She's wearing a white gown, the moon is very full, the windows of her room are stained glass, and the light of the moon passing through the stained glass windows splashes her with color. And Keats has such a glorious poet's time assigning the various colors here and there. Just the joy in the sensory experience of the colors is projected. Meanwhile, Porphyro's in the closet and about to swoon. And Madeline arises and begins to undress. Now this is very precarious material for Keats. You see, imagine how Euripides might have staged this. There have been a great thwacking of bladders and flailing of phallic puns and so forth. Or imagine how the wife of Bath might have told this story. It would have been a bit goaty. You see, there was a man named Minsky who worked with this material for quite a number of years. And I suppose Keats could have persuaded Porphyro not to look, But there's that about poets, you can't keep them from peeking. They have to look. And Keats wouldn't have imagined it. He therefore has a problem. And the passage, this is about the third or fourth draft. You can get these worksheets, incidentally, by writing to the Houghton Library in Harvard, and they will send you photostats of them, and you can see the changes Keats made as he worked over them. Anon his heart revives. Her vespers done, she has finished praying. Of all its wreathed pearls, she frees her hair, unclasps her warmed jewels one by one. Well, that line you recognize in the final. And warmed jewels has been praised so often, and I think so justly. The jewels are warmed because they have been in contact with her body. See, what else would warm them? And it's at this marvelous, delicate second remove that Keats wants to suggest the presence of Madeline's body. So you have a kind of sequence, wreathed pearls, warmed jewels. They go nicely together. Then he gets to the next line. He has, of all its wreathed pearls, she frees her hair, unclasps her warmed jewels one by one, loosens her bursting bodice. Now, what sort of sequence is wreathed pearls, warmed jewels, bursting bodice? And may I point out to you that nothing in the physical universe says that Madeline's bust measurement has anything to do with the characteristics Keats wants to give her. There's something in the quality, the tonality of the word burst. You know, run for your lives, the dam's burst. it's a mischord. Wreathed pearls, warmer jewels, bursting bodice, no. And Keats knew it instantly. He crossed out bursting. He backed up and he was tempted to cheat. Now, I think he has an obligation to. Three is a magic number. And having said wreathed pearls, adjective noun, warmed jewels, adjective noun, he needs another adjective noun combination and one to carry this wreathed warmed sequence. Instead, he backs up and tries to say, undoes her bodice lace strings. Well, that's ugly to say, and it's a cheat. It's not an adjective noun thing. And I suppose Keats could have said to himself, look, John, you're a major poet, and those English teachers are all sheep. Who's going to call you on it? You know, let it go. But that's not the way it happens. You're trying to make it right for its own sake, and an insistent ear is there to insist. And after many scratchings, he came up with, I think, the miraculous. If you want something to flip about, I think this is flippable. Undoes her fragrant bodice. Now, fragrant's a very ordinary word, isn't it? But it does for bodice exactly what warmed does for jewels. The bell just chimes. The jewels are warmed because they have touched her body. The bodice is fragrant because it has touched her body. And these are exact equivalents. You could almost say this is like a solution in mathematics, to sound exactly the same tone and quantity again, with very ordinary words trapped in context. I think it's a marvelous solution, you see, of a contract picked up along the way. Keats runs into another problem that I think is funny. Unclasps her fragrant bodice and doth bear, he's rhyming with hair, her, well, what? He's up against the naked truth he's been trying to skirt all the way through this passage. So he went back and did something. He inverted the rhyme line. Anon his heart revives, her vespers done, of all its wreathed pearls her hair she frees, unclasps her warmed jewels one by one, loosens her fragrant bodice by degrees, her rich attire creeps rustling to her knees, pensive a while, a mermaid in seaweed, she dreams awake and sees St. Agnes Fair and so forth. But I think that's funny too, because here she is, her dress has crept to her knees, and here she stands buck naked, dreaming a while in this castle, and I think of the first lines of the poem, St. Agnes Eve, ah, bitter chill it was. The owl, for all its feathers, was a cold. The hare limped, trembling through the frozen grass. And here within this Alaska of the mind, she's standing with her clothes down about her knees, pensive a while, and I don't think they had central heating in those castles. There's maybe a lapse in there, and I'm not prepared to philosophize it, but certainly Keats solved his first problem, I think, rather elegantly. Let me try it again with a different kind of poem. I'm trying to pick up a theme and carry it.
At this point, unfortunately, we must leave Mr. Ciardi to rejoin him next week for the remaining half of his presentation. This evening on the University of Alaska Forum, we've presented the poet John Ciardi, who visited the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus on March 24th, 1972. This has been Tom Duncan. Join us again next week at the same time for part two of two programs on the poet John Ciardi. You have been listening to the University of Alaska Radio Forum. The University of Alaska Radio Forum was produced in the studios of KUAC at College for the University of Alaska Broadcasting Service. This is the University of Alaska Radio Forum. Each week at this time, Forum presents a topic of timely and pertinent interest to Alaskans. Now, here is today's host. This is Tom Duncan, and welcome once again to the University of Alaska Radio Forum. Today's program is the second of two from a lecture given by poet John Ciardi, March 24, 1972, at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. During the first part of the program, Mr. Ciardi discussed some of his poetry and general aesthetics on poetic writing. We return to Mr. Ciardi as he turns to focus on one of his own works.
Let me try it again with a different kind of poem. I'm trying to pick up a theme and carry it. I did some poems from Italy, and one of the things that attracted me in these poems was the figure of the old woman in black that one sees around the Italian countryside. Somehow all Italian peasant women, anyhow, end up as black figures in a landscape. Somebody has always died, and there's always somebody to mourn for, and by the time you're well into the family, you see these bent over, their hands are withered from toil, they look like driftwood, and somehow you have a feeling this is the genie of this place. This old woman in black sitting on a doorstep has been here since the Greeks left her. You see, in 500 B.C., nobody could possibly see more memory from this place than this woman does sitting here. She's been a child here, chances are. She's been a woman, raised her family. Now she is sitting at the last of her life looking out over the landscape. So I made up a name for her. Nonna in Italian means grandmother, and I just made up a common enough Italian name because I like the sounds of it. Nonna Domenica Garnaro. Has a nice vowel thing. Sits in the sun on the step of her house in Calabria. And a number of people have said to me, how do you like Calabria? Well, I've never been there. I could have said Puglia, but that wouldn't have been the right sound. Or I could have said Lucarno. Well, that wouldn't have been the right sound. Or I could have said Lazio or Lombardy. But somehow, the sound balance for Nonna Domenica Garnaro is Calabria. It has the right open vowels. And what is place accuracy? That's not the accuracy of the poem. It's to make the elements balance on one another. I've been within 20 miles of Calabria, if I need a justification. And I've flown over it. Does that justify me? I don't care which you want to take. But people are always insisting on a wrong literalism. It was just the right Italian geographical name to go with the name I had invented. And so I've been there in imagination. Nonna Domenica Garnado sits in the sun on the step of her house in Calabria. There are 7 men and 4 women in the village who call her Mamma. And the orange trees fountain there blooms down all the hill and valley. No one can see more memory from this step than Nonna Domenica. When she folds her hands in her lap, they fall together like 2 Christs fallen from a driftwood shrine. All their weathers are twisted into them. There is that art in them that will not be carved, but can only be waited for. These hands are not sad, nor happy, nor tired, nor strong. They are simply complete. They lie still in her lap, and she sits waiting quietly in the sun for what will happen. As, for example, a petal may blow down on the wind and lie across both of her thumbs, and she looked down at it. Well, I wrote that poem enough years ago, so I think I'm fairly dispassionate toward it. It's been at least 20 years, perhaps longer. I think it works. I hope it works. If it does work, I think it would illustrate something the Bauhaus school once said, though I didn't know it at the time I wrote this poem. Less is more. You see, the lighter effect can be a better resolution than the heavier effect. And I like the quietness of that final image. This woman with the hands like driftwood is sitting on the step with her hands folded so, just doing that, and she looks down, and a petal has lodged, fallen on the wind, and lodged across both of her thumbs. And obviously, if you want to get heavily symbolic about it, the weathered flesh and the one leaf of the petal lying across it make a kind of statement by juxtaposition. And nothing happens except that. But I like the quietness of it. But I'd like to point out to you that I could not put a petal on those 2 thumbs in the 3rd stanza if I had not had orange trees in the 1st stanza. See, any petal that falls inside a poem has to fall from inside it. It can't fall from outside into the poem. Once the trees have been established, they're there to be used. Now, I did not know I was going to use the trees in this way. But they made an opportunity I seized on, and I think that's another kind of contract. What am I saying? Let's assume with the inspirationalist that the first line of a poem comes from God knows where. And maybe the second line, or I should say the second element of the poem comes from God knows where. Maybe the 3rd one comes from God knows where too, but it had better come from God knows where by way of the first 2. It can't slide laterally into the poem. It has to come in from the top and go vertically into it and use what's there. We're mentioning this just a few minutes ago, now that I have it in mind, something Chekhov said: if you bring a cannon on stage, fire it. And the corollary of that would be, if you're going to fire it, make sure it's on stage. And get it on stage as inconspicuously as possible for later usage. It won't do simply to have it lit and ready to go off and have it go boom the minute it appears. That interferes with the reader's willingness to believe you. And when the reader ceases to believe you, you're done. I'm going to try another example. This is a poem that has not been published yet, but I think I'm ready to let it get published, in which an accident put a lot of things together for me. I have a couple of acres of lawn that have to be taken care of, and so I acquired a Sears Roebuck 12 horsepower ride-around tractor. And this is a poem about my power mower, and I have to make careful note, that is 2 words, power mower. I once read this poem and somebody said, what's the name of that poem about your paramour? He said, language is very tricky. you've got to keep focused very, very closely on it or you're in trouble. It's called On the Orthodoxy and Creed of My Paramour. Now, one of the things I have in mind is that I am a Stone Age mechanic. The mysteries of the I can explain Trinity. I can explain the redemption of sin. I can explain metempsychosis. But don't ask me about the internal combustion engine. I have a theory of it, but I can't get all the pieces ever back together again properly. And yet, Sears Roebuck gave me a manual of things to do in the fall, and I felt like a priest holding the book of the sacraments, you see. You pour the holy oil here, and you seal here, and you do this thing. And I'm kneeling while I do this. It's a religious ritual. But come spring, nothing ever happens. I repeat the ritual. I anoint myself. I anoint it. I invoke the dryads. And I push the button, and nothing happens. And I conclude that my lawnmower is Catholic. If this were a Protestant lawnmower, I could work it out in conscience between me and the source of energy. But this will respond only to the ministering touch, so I have to call Sears Roebuck, and they send an anointed priest who comes with the right ritual, and he gives it the oils and the blessings and touches it, and it comes to life again, and there we go. But all of this started partly with my sense of the... I've been interested in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance when this sort of question would come up in more formal context. But I was also thinking, what a stinking noise it takes to make a tidy lawn. And how can you get neatness from this kind of lunacy? The lawnmower rages over the grass, and I look back and it's all nicely cut. And somehow lunacy and noise shouldn't produce that. And I was trying to say something about the loudness of the mower. And I began toying with the idea of the mating cry of a male bulldozer. I thought that would be loud enough, but I couldn't work it into the poem. And finally I hit on another one. I said, all summer in power, out roaring the bull fiend. Now, the only thing I wanted from bull fiend was noisiness. And a bull fiend has to be noisy. I feel he has to be noisy. And after all, I legislate feeling in my own poems. But as soon as I let a fiend in, what else have I let in? I've let the opposite of fiend and the whole hierarchy in between. And I think it was almost by accident I got under this religious thing. And I think it has made a poem. I hope it has. I've had it in my notebook for several years, and I think I'm ready to take a chance with it. All summer in power, out roaring the bull fiend, it raves on my lawn, spewing into the dirty lung hung on its side. Myself maddened by power, I ride the howl of hot new mown sacks full, the powder bursts of gnashed mole runs, till in one sweaty half day of the beast, my lawn is lined to tidy passages. So, neatness from lunacy, the orderliness of rage, Bedlam's Eden, all calm now, the dead beast washed in cool light and stalled. Again and again all summer in power at a touch it frenzies. At fall's dry last, I kneel to the manual, to the word, touch, and pour extreme unctions, that the locked life waken when called, and do call year after year in season to the lunacy of power, and am not answered. I probe, prime, pump, and might as well pray to headless stone gods. Nothing I know wakens the power blast hidden in it, which is no cause of Protestant conscience to be worked out between me and the source, but a priest-held power of maintenance. Well, let us in back. Always at last defeated, I call, and its priest comes with cups, knowledge, and the anointed touch that does reach power and mystery. The beast gasps, shakes, wavers deep in itself, then roars full to resurrection, and here we come to cure green again. Our triumph of faith, which is, of course, that even the powerless and inept may ride fit power
once wakened by the anointed man, believed in deeper than conscience and defeat, whole in his knowledge given, his touch charged, the dangerous blind beast tame in service.
Well, you see, there's some light touches in the poem, but there are also some serious ones. And that's one way of getting into trouble with readers. Readers, by and large, are 19th century readers, and they want you to be all serious or all funny. And most non-intellectual readers, let me put it that way, are offended by a poem that is both serious and playful at the same time. Somehow the school system has drilled into you that it's the good, the true, the beautiful you should resonate when you pick up a poem. But what do you do when you're feeling ambiguous about it? Here's a poem I'm fond of, written for a friend of mine, Theodore Retke, who is dead in body, but whose poems, I think, are regularly invading the school system because they're good, they have to. Retke, I guess one of the reasons I cling to Retke is that as I get older and uglier, I begin to look like him. At least I begin to take on his outline. He was a huge man, a compulsive athlete. He was once runner-up, I think, for the state title as junior tennis champ of Michigan. And even 50 pounds later, he played a furious, demented game of tennis with certain psychological advantages. If you were playing net and he came charging down the baseline, you flinched. You were afraid he was going to break through the net the way he was coming at you. He was brought up in the shadow of Paul Bunyan in Saginaw, Michigan, and half believed he was Paul Bunyan. He used to tell fantastic tales, and he'd get roaring drunk, and yet when he sat down and began to write, the miracle happened. See, a little like Ben Jonson, brawling all night, coming home stinking drunk, and then writing one of those sweetest lyrics. This happened to Retke. Moreover, had nervous disorders. He lived on a kind of manic depressive sine curve, and sometimes he was in the sanitarium, made frequent visits there, and poetry was one of his ways back. The psychiatrist knew when he was recovering, when his poems began to take shape again. I've known a psychiatrist who had a poet as a patient. He said, he's beginning to write poems, and it's as if a hen suddenly laid 900 eggs. But it's a sure sign. Pretty soon, the poems will stop just being verbal spill, and they'll begin to take form. And a couple of weeks later, I'll be able to discharge him. See, that incantation that leads back to order. I think it's very basic to poetry. It's a way of keeping an order. Retke has a poem called Saginaw, and this is roughly toward his measure because it was a tribute to him, and I wanted to use his form for it. Ted Retke was a tearing man, a slam, bang, wham, dam, tantrum, oh, from Saginaw in Michigan, where the ladies sneeze at 10 below, but any man that's half a man can keep a sweat up till the freeze gets down to 99 degrees, for the hair on their chests that hangs down to their knees in Saginaw in Michigan. Ted Retke was a drinking man, a brandy and a bubbly, oh. He wore a roll of fat that ran 6 times around his belly, oh, then tucked back in where it began. And every ounce of every pound of that great lard was built around the very best hoots that could be found in Saginaw, in Michigan. Ted Retke was an athlete, so it's pronounced in Michigan. He played to win and was hard to beat, and he'd scream like an orangutan and claw the air and stamp his feet at every shot he couldn't make and every point he couldn't take. And when he lost, he'd hold a wake. Or damn you for a cheat. Sometimes he was a friend of mine with the empties on the floor, oh. And God, it's fun to be feeling fine and to pour and pour and pour, oh. But just to show we were not swine, we kept a clock that was stopped at 10, and we never started before then.
And just to prove we were gentlemen, we quit when it got to 9. Ted Retke was a roaring man, a ring-tailed, wing-ding, yippee-oh. He could out-yell all Michigan and half the Mississippi, oh. But once he sat still and began to listen for the lifting word, it hovered round him like a bird. And oh, sweet Christ, the things he heard in Saginaw, in Michigan. Now Retke's dead. If there's a man awaking, lost, and wanting, oh, in Saginaw, in Michigan, he could hear all his haunting, oh, in the same wind where it began, the terrors it could not outface, but found the words of. And by grace of what words are, found time and place in Saginaw, in Michigan. I think I believe that as an ascetic faith. By the grace of words, we find out things. Sometimes a poem is a definite way, even a positive way of learning something. I'd like to read you a poem called Three Views of a Mother, in which something I had always known suddenly focused in the course of a poem. My mother came to this country when she was 12, and she didn't exactly join it. She built a sort of spore sack around herself and lived in her own imagination of mountain memory. And at the end, there's something I was feeling for, and this poem told it to me. The line is, I think perhaps this woman is my child. And suddenly I knew it. My mother was no longer my mother. She had become my daughter. And I've seen this happen in other people. I think it happens to all but truly intellectual women. And that's a good reason for educating women. Because this relationship is a good one, but there are better ones, I think. Because it's inarticulate. There were so many things I would have liked to have said to her, but we had never found the vocabulary for them. You see, she was satisfied to become the little girl to her big son. As I say, that's not the least rewarding thing, but I discovered it in the way of this poem. Partly, it began with watching her playing with my daughter. I'm going to skip one part of it. Good soul, my mother holds my daughter, the onion skin bleached hand under the peach head. Titi, she says, from the vegetable world. La la, a language of roots from a forgotten garden. She forms like a cresting wave over the child. It is impossible not to see her break and bury, and the child swim up a girl and the girl reach shore, a woman on my last beach. Titi, la la, I will not fight our drowning nor the fall of gardens. I am curious, however, to know what world this is. The honeydew head of the child, the cauliflower head of the grandmother, bob in the sea under the garden. Titi, la la, the grandmother rustles her hands like two dry leaves, and the child writhes round as a slug for pleasure, leaving the trail of its going wet on the world. Then there's a passage about fall gardens, but this is the one I want to get to, part 3. Three rainy days and the fourth one sunny. She was gone before breakfast. At 3, she hobbles back under a flour sack bulging full of mushrooms. Well, scolding will do no good. I see her eyes hunting for praise as she fishes up a handful and holds them to the light, then rips one open for me to smell the earth and the white stem. I think perhaps this woman is my child. But right now, what do we do with 30 pounds of uncleaned mushrooms? If I let her be, she'll stay up cleaning them till 1 o'clock and be all aches tomorrow. I get a knife, and here we sit with the kitchen table between us, one pile for root ends, one for the clean sprouts. Her hands go back with her. I see her mind open through fields from the earth of her stained fingers. Once, when I was a girl, I found a fungus that weighed 28 kilos. That's obviously a lie, but memory exaggerates. I found a fungus that weighed 28 kilos. It was delicious. I was going to Benevento for the fair. I cut across the mountain to save time, and there it was, like an angel in a tree. You don't see things like that, not over here. My father ran from the barn when I came home. "Didn't you go to the fair?" he said. But I laughed. I brought it home with me. He wouldn't believe I'd carried it all the way across the mountain and the path so steep. I made a sack of my skirt. He thought some fellow, I don't know what he thought. Titi, Lala, the memory works her fingers. Oh, we were happy then. You could go in the winter and dig the roses and cabbages from the snow. The land had a blessing in it. In the fall, in the vineyards, we sang from dawn to sunset, and at night we washed our feet and danced like goats in the grape vats. The wine came up like blood between our toes. We finish at last. The squid gray fruit before us. Leave the root clippings, she says, there for the garden. See how the black the dirt is. Black's for growing. She sets her hoard to soak. I'm tired now. Sometimes I talk too much. That's happiness. Well, so we'll eat again before we die. But oh, if you could have seen it in that tree. The kind of nonsense that goes on when your fingers are busy. I'd like to close, not as a break, but in sequence, with some poems I've been taking very seriously, and for which a number of the critics have scolded me. I began writing children's poems, playing games with my children, and I've fallen in love with the process. And when somebody says, "What's Charlie doing writing children's poems?" The answer is, "He's having a hell of a good time, you damn fool." There's something wrong with a man that would ask that question. As if you were guilty of something for having a good time with children. As if Lewis Carroll were not a better poet than Wordsworth. I don't know. Partly because I want revenge on the kids. I'm going to read three poems and close with these are short. There was a man who lived in Perth. He had about $5 worth of boys and girls at three for a dollar. The less they were worth, the more they would holler. The more they would holler, the less they were worth. For 2 cents cash, I'd send you to Perth. I insist that poem announces that it is over, doesn't it? It has found its end. Here's one I read in Sarasota a while back, Sarasota, Florida. I decided the last line should be dedicated to the city of Sarasota. Baxter Bickerbone of Burlington used to be sheriff till he lost his gun, used to be a teacher till he lost his school, used to be the Iceman till he lost his cool, used to be a husband till he lost his wife, used to be alive till he lost his life. When he got to heaven, Baxter said, "The climate's very healthy once you're used to being dead." That's for Sarasota, Florida. Have you been there? All right, one more and then we'll break. Susie's new dog, and then again, the literalist question. Did you really have a little neighbor named Susie who had a little dog? The answer is no, but I've got a German Shepherd and that's a dog, and anything this small and fluffy isn't. And this is just a reaction of German Shepherd owners against this kind of dog, so I invented a little girl to bring it to him, and I had a conversation with him. "Your dog? What dog? You mean it? That?" I was about to leave a note pinned to a fish to warn my cat to watch for a mouse in an overcoat. So that's a dog. Is it any breed that anyone ever knew or guessed? Oh, a flea terrier. Yes, indeed. Well, now I am impressed. I guess no robber will try your house or even cut through your yard. Not when he knows you have a dog like that on guard. You have to go? I'm glad you came. I don't see a thing like that just every day. Does it have a name? Fang, eh? Well, I must warn my cat. I think Fang is a precision in there. Had I said Fluffy or Fido or Snookums, it would have spoiled the irony of it. It has to be Fang. Well, I must call my cat.
John Chiardi, this week's featured guest on the University of Alaska Radio Forum. Mr. Chiardi appeared at the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus on March 24, 1972, as part of the annual Festival of the Arts. This has been Tom Duncan. Thank you very much for listening, and join us again next week for the University of Alaska Radio Forum. Listening to the University of Alaska Radio Forum. The University of Alaska Radio Forum was produced in the studios of KUAC at College for the University of Alaska Broadcasting Service.